You are now listening to the Black Girl Nerds Podcast.
Five, six, seven, eight. Holla, boys and girls, it's the BGN. Coming from the Marvel world to the DC friends. All the way from Hollywood to the PCN. She defends everyone from sleazy men. Won't apologize for spitting Shonda Rhimes. The space that we make is never colonized. Talking games and movies and actors.
Word? Better shake your booties for Black Girl Nerds. Better shake your booties for Black Girl Nerds. Better shake your booties for Black Girl Nerds. Better shake your booties for Black Girl Nerds.
The Legendborn cycle continues with Oathbound, the shocking third book from number one New York Times bestselling author Tracy Dion. This contemporary fantasy series explores reimagined Arthurian legends, centuries-old legacies and betrayals, and, at the center of it all, a Black girl whose magic changes everything. In Legendborn, Bree infiltrated a secret magical society descended from King Arthur's knights, looking for answers about her mother's death, only to discover her own ancestral power. The second book, Bloodmarked, introduced new characters, explored more romance, and uncovered a deeper mystery. And in the third book, Oathbound, Bree Matthews and her friends must now face their own demons, with devastating consequences. Start reading Oathbound and catch up on the Legendborn Cycle series. Available wherever books are sold. Thanks for tuning into this episode of the Black Girl Nerds Podcast. My name is Jamie and I am your host. So we covered Sundance. It's passed a couple of weeks now since the recording of this episode. And this episode is going to talk about Sundance as if it's in the present tense, because when we did the recording, we were in the thick of it. But I wanted to get this out because I think it's very important, number one, that we always reflect on some of the great, talented, independent films that come out of Sundance. And also, you can use this episode to reflect back on the films that we've covered at Sundance that you'll find out about later on down the road when they get picked up by distributors and get released in theaters. So with that said, we are very excited about this episode because it's a two-part episode. In the first segment, we have the film Cardam, which played in the World Cinema Documentary Competition. I had the pleasure of speaking with four of the directors of that film: Anas Saeed, Rawia Alhag, Ibrahim Snoopy, and Tamia Ahmed. Cardam is a very powerful film that deals with the area in Sudan of East Africa following an outbreak of war, and five citizens of Cardam, including a civil servant, a tea lady, a resistance committee volunteer, and two young bottle collectors, reenact their stories of survival and freedom through dreams, revolution, and civil war. Again, I sat down and spoke with the filmmakers at Sundance to talk about this incredibly impactful film. In our second segment, I sit down with Travis Hobson of Punch Drunk Critics to talk about the movies that we liked and maybe didn't like so much over at Sundance. Again, keep in mind, when this was recorded, we were still in the middle of Sundance, so we didn't watch all of the films that had played at Sundance at the time of the recording. So just keep that in mind as you're listening to this episode. But we do go over a pretty good amount of films that we both watched and consumed. We have some agreements here, some disagreements there, but I always love to unpack what I liked and I did not like when I go to these different film festivals, and I'm so honored to have Travis join me in that discussion. So sit back, relax, and enjoy this two-part episode of the Black Girl Nerds Podcast as we break down Sundance 2025. First up, the filmmakers of Cardam, and then the second segment, a discussion about the films we liked and didn't like. Enjoy. And just a quick production note, one of the filmmakers speaks in Arabic throughout the interview and does have a translator to translate what she says back and forth. So just want to give you a heads up that some of the interview will be spoken in Arabic, but then that will be translated into English. So thanks so much for taking the time to speak to Black Girl Nerds. I really appreciate that we're going to have a conversation about your film, Cardam. I really enjoyed watching this, and it's a very provocative film that really moved me, and I really hope that more people get a chance to see it and be exposed to it. So my first question is to Anas, and first of all, am I pronouncing your name right?
Yeah.
Okay. What inspired you to create a documentary like this in the first place, and why tell this story now?
Khartoum film was a crazy idea, really, because we started before the war, and we like stopped, and after that we decided to contain our film. And my inspired me to create a documentary film because Sudan is different and big country and diverse. And it has a lot of, it's rich, local language, different type of, and also culture.
And for Rawia, am I pronouncing your name right?
Yes.
Okay. This was such a deeply provocative movie, and the stories that were told were filled with so much detail. Were there any stories or moments from filming that you decided it was just too much and you decided to keep out of the film?
هل في جزء كان من الفيلم كان حسيت انه الموضوع ده too much يعني كثير شديد تقيل كده وحسيت انه المفروض اخلوه برا الفيلم؟
اوكي. زي ما قال انس احنا بدينا الفيلم قبل 3 سنة اللي هو قبل الحرب بسنة ونص. الفيلم كان فيه مشاهد كثيرة قبل الحرب, بس بعد الحرب نحن الوضع بالنسبة لي تغير, وحتى الشركاء حقين لنا من جو وقررنا نحن نواصل تصوير الفيلم في كينيا.
So as Anna said, we started 3 years ago, and as Rawia is saying, as Anna said, 3 years ago, we started the production of the film. And that was a year and a half before the war happened. And after the war happened, everything went chaotic, and we also lost communication with our subjects.
Okay, في كينيا لما شركائنا جو وحكوا لنا حياتهم بعد الحرب بقت عاملة كيف, وحكوا لنا الرحلة بتاعتهم لحد ما وصلوا كينيا. صراحة في حكاوي كثيرة نحنا ما طفناها ضمن الفيلم, لأنه حسينا إن الحاجة دي هي حرفين هي قاسية لينا وقاسية لهم هم ذاتهم.
So after we got to Kenya and we again gathered with all the participants and directors, we had a lot of talks and discussions with our participants, and some of the stories were very just too heavy to tell and to reflect for them, for us, and even maybe some for audience.
Okay, برضو من ضمن الحاجات دي كان في مشهد له علاقة بالأطفال, وهم هناك أثناء الحرب كانوا شغالين في السوق. في أثناء شغلهم في السوق كانت المعارك بتحصل, فحتى كان يعني في جزء من المشهد ده تعرض في الفيلم اللي هو الطريقة اللي كان بيعلموا فيها لوكين وويلسون جواد ومجي كيف يمسكوا السلاح وكيف يغادروا في المعركة وكيف ينجوا أثناء المعركة في السوق.
So one of these scenes is the kids, Lokena and Wilson, when they were at war. They were working in the middle of the conflict between guns and clashes between the conflicting parties, and we couldn't even show that. But even there's a part of it in the film in the green screen scenes when Lucaine and Wilson shows Jawada and Mejdi how to hold guns and how to fight in the battle, how they when they saw the other fighters on field.
I mean, this film is so compelling, and there's just a lot that happens. Were there any moments where you felt you were in the throes of danger? And anybody can really answer that question. It just kind of struck me as you were going through, when you were explaining that to me.
Say it again.
Where you felt like you were, you know, in danger while you were filming.
هل حسيت بخطر لما كنت بتصور؟
في لما كنا في خرطوم قبل الحرب احنا كنا بنصور في الشارع فكنا بنصور لوكين وولسون والتيم كله بيصور من ضمن المصورين كان أنس وأنس وسنوبي ومعانا يوسف في الشارع في السودان خطر انك تصور بالذات اذا يعني مشاهد زي مشاهد لوكين وولسون فصراحة التيم اتعرض ل يعني الناس ضربوا التيم Yusuf,
Snoopy, and Anas, yani. So, before the war, it was not easy to record footage in Khartoum. It was very complex to just roam around with, and especially for the kids. And honestly, one of the days when I was like with Snoopy and Anas and also Yusuf, people just they come to beat us like in the streets.
If I can add,
yeah
please. So basically we were shooting down the street, just mm-hmm. a scene where we were across the street, and then I was just framing the shot that Rawia, because it was her film,
mm-hmm.
so I was just DPing me and Anas, so I was framing across the street, and then she was guiding Lucaine and Winston on, you know, how to move, where to move around the frame. Then suddenly a random guy just came up to her and then started, you know, yelling and then, you know, shouting. So we immediately crossed the street and, you know, trying to figure out what's the problem. And suddenly we were surrounded by around 20 to 30 people. And then it took us some seconds, then we started fighting all these guys. You know, I was injured, Anas was injured,
wow.
Joe was hit on his head, and I still have, like, scars on my hand because of that. Then the police came, and then they basically didn't do anything. They just took us to the station, and they told us you guys should have got permission, but we already got it. But they're just trying to find an excuse to justify, you know, the whole thing, then siding with people. The reason for that was because the kids, Lucaine and Winston, also are seen as outcasts in the community. So us filming that, because a lot of people in the community didn't want to see or send out this kind of image that these are kids that are, you know, on the streets collecting bottles and all that. So they didn't want to send out that message. So whenever they felt like we're filming that, they immediately stopped us and said that this isn't representing us. We don't want that to be out in the out of Sudan. So that's why everyone was, you know, attacking us.
And follow up on what you're saying, I want to ask you, Ibrahim, is that...
Yes,
okay. There were clearly challenges while filming this film. We saw the first shots of the movie.
Mm.
I mean, what you just described there, we see that in the film. So can you share more about those challenges, and was there a moment that happened in the film where you couldn't even get it made? Like, it didn't make it into the film.
Mm. I guess that تريم ولا
تريم
قالت إنه
هل كان في مشاهد في الفيلم كان في can you repeat just the last part please?
Yeah, was there a moment where it was so challenging that it didn't even make it into the movie?
هل كان في لحظات فيها تحدي عالي شديد أو صعبة شديد لدرجة إنها أصلاً ما تعملت يعني ما لحقت تكون في الفيلم؟
It is if you look at the film you will see it's hyper between interview some fellow character in Khartoum it will image from mix yeah that after the war we don't have any footage when the characters sprung from the Khartoum, from the war, and they spent in Khartoum during the war like 6 months, and there is no any communication, there is no any footage, and they facing a lot of problems there. And after that they told us, and we fixed that about by green screen. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that, and also it's like five characters, five directors, it's a lot of things. And also before they share their event, we did also before the react
Yeah, I cannot hear, if I may. So as I was saying, we faced a lot of challenging in the next phase, in the phase after the war of the film, because we didn't have any footage of the escape, of what happened within the conflict. It was very not easy to collect footage from this phase. So we came up with doable collective creative solutions, which is like the reconstruction or the reimitation scenes when our subjects, like they literally just stand on a green screen and tell us, this was that, here was a couch, here I was walking, here was I was with my son, and we started that just to show that phase that we couldn't have footage or to record from. And the way we navigated through that we ourselves as directors has faced similar challenges as the subjects. We didn't have electricity for at least few days. We didn't have internet for a lot of periods. Lack of safety for transportation, or even when sitting at home, it was challenging for all of us because we stayed in the conflict area for more than we thought. So we were telling them, okay, so I was standing here, and then I was in my bed. RSF soldier came into my house, took the car, and then he told me where is the money in the house, etc. So, for example, me, I was like recreating this and telling, I was laying on the bed, I was having this, I walked two steps, etc. So they can understand more what is the dreamscape or the reconstruction on the green screen scenes that we need. And it turned out to be very, very good, as I think.
And also I want to add, before the war also we had killing, as Snoopy already said, and also in the demonstration, when I was shooting the police, beating the resistance community, I was there, we shoot, and it's difficult, it's not easy, because it gas everywhere, bombang gas, we call bombang.
Tear gas.
Yeah, it make you, يعني, it was, أنا حصل لي غماء في واحدة من المواكب.
So in few words, that pre-war, it was also challenging, and we knew that from the beginning, because Sudan was going into post-coup kind of an era, and the government was still anti, you know, protesters, anti-people. So Anas was one of the people who were on the front lines filming the protest, as you can see in the film. And he's just describing that at some point he fainted. Oh. They had to, like, you know, evacuate him from the protest because he was filming additional, you know, shots for the film.
And in the same time, when I was resistance community, I will feel safe. Everything that happened to me, they took me out and they take care of. We take care of us. Mm-hmm. Everyone there in the demonstration, he's safe. Even if you got shot or anything, your colleague and the give you out and place. Yeah. Yeah. Safe place.
Yeah.
And it's incredible that you guys just kept going through it, this process, and having to deal with these really life-threatening challenges. Tamia, for you, these participants had to reenact these very horrifying stories of trauma. How did you balance creative storytelling with the reenactments, along with the ethical responsibility of making certain that you're being authentic to their experiences?
Yeah, that was
your question. So, كيف قدرت توزن بين انك تخلي المشهد اللي عندنا تمثيله يكون حقيقي ما يكون مصنع، بين انه يكون يعني مضاف للفيلم.
So that was challenging for sure, because our priority was to keep everyone safe physically and mentally. So even us, after we got into Kenya, which is the first and last stop for the film geographically, we had therapy sessions and therapy discussions, and we had a professional therapist that helped us as the directors to realize what happened, to ignite it, to discuss it, to talk about it, and to feel more safe. And when the participants came also to the station in Kenya, we also did the same. We were not even talking about what are we shooting or how are we shooting. There was the idea of the film, but the top priority was keeping everyone safe mentally and physically. So we did the same process as the therapy sessions, as the discussions. We talked among each other. We are not far from what happened. I stayed 6 months in Khartoum. Snoopy stayed for also a few months. Rawia the same, and it's the same. We faced the same struggles like most of the Sudanese people. So we understand what happened to them, and they understand what happened to us. And we take care of each other as a big, as we call it, cinematic family. And the most important thing was they were aware, and they were like very empowered, and they wanted to tell their stories.
Yeah.
All of us were looking at this film as the chance to tell the Sudan's story in a way that is not journalistic, that is not a reportage that comes from any news channels. It's retelling Sudan's story in a more poetic, cinematic, in a more sense that people could feel it, not just know it.
And in one moment, maybe you think like I can. I dare بقول إنه في لحظة من اللحظات ممكن تكسر الحنك يعني تفكر إنك هتكسر الحنك يعني تفكر يعني بيتمر مرينا باللحظات فيها إحباط يعني بعد ذاك وكنت استمعنا لحكايات بعض فدي اللي قوتنا وشجعتنا إننا نحاول نحكي قصصنا للعالم يعني.
Yeah. I mean, in every production, I guess that filmmakers go through a phase where they're depressed, frustrated, not knowing what to do, thinking of dropping the project. But we were empowering each other, and then we took this oath of we need to finish this film. Mm-hmm. It's not just another film anymore. It's a triumphant kind of a resisting way of reflecting what's happening in Sudan to the whole world.
But عايز أضيف الحاجة خلت المشاهد بتاعت الكريم سكرين إنها تكون مشاهد حقيقية إنه قبل ما نبدأ تصوير إحنا عملنا زي ورشة بتاعت تمثيل وريناهم كيف يقدروا يعبروا عن نفسهم وعن مشاعرهم الحقيقية وكيف يستفيد يخلوا الناس التانيين يشاركوهم في حكي قصصهم كيف فدي أهم حاجة.
Rabi is saying one of the most important things to me and what made the green screen or the reconstruction scenes real and authentic is that we did some workshops pre-shooting how to do it, how to integrate with each other, how to reflect the feelings and how to tell that in an authentic way.
I really love the animation too, and it was very immersive, and I, you know, it really helped enhance the storytelling. Anas, how does it feel to have your work showcased in a competition that celebrates a diverse range of global perspectives?
Go again, please.
How does it feel to have your work showcased in a competition that celebrates a diverse range of global perspectives?
حاسس كيف إنه شغلك بيتعكس في منصة عالمية زي دي ومتنوعة بشكل ممتاز يعني.
I'm so excited to share my
to share our film with global universal cinema, and we need to cinema house to know about Sudan. It's rich country. It has a lot of stories no one tell it before, and I hope this is to be the first one, and I expect more than Sudanese stories in the cinema house.
Yeah, I hope for more of those stories as well. Yes. And Rawia, for you, do you feel this film will spark wider conversations or even inspire social change in this region, and if so, how?
حاسة إن الفيلم حيخلق نوع من ال يعني الحديث وال يعني الكلام عن السودان في الزيادة من العالم. إنه حيخلي الناس إنه تتكلم أو في حاجة اسمها السودان وحاصل شنو كده. إنه نشوف الفيلم ده يكون فيه نوع ده من ال يعني conversation.
أنا مؤمنة تماماً إن الأفلام بتعمل تغيير. والفيلم ده أنا متأكدة إنه حيعمل تغيير في ردة الفعل بتاعت الناس تجاه السودان عموماً، لأنه يعني كون زول يحضر فيلم ويحضر قصة بتاعت إنسان ويتعلق عاطفياً بإنسان ما زي لما يقراها كرقم في تقرير أخباري.
I believe that films create change. And I believe that our film will do that. And I also believe that it's a user for nostalgia.
الفيلم
هيعمل
تغيير متأكدة عشان هنا يعني دي قصص إنسانية ما تغيير أخبار.
So because audience in cinemas will look in the participants and feel something. It will not be just another reportage from a news channel or just numbers of how many are displaced or how many are dead or etc.
Mm-hmm. And Ibrahim, is there a scene or a moment during filming that still resonates with you?
هل في لحظة أنت لسه يعني بتحس كأنك مرتبط بها في الفيلم يعني في كده connection بينك وبين اللحظة؟ Can you rephrase it just to
Yeah, is there a scene that still sticks with you that you still remember after you finish this movie?
هل في مشهد انت لسه يعني بتتذكره كده بتفاصيله؟ I guess that the kids, it was fun and challenging.
Yeah, I love the kids.
And at the same time, for the scene where they were riding, you know, the donkey, you know, going to, you know, pick bottles. I guess that to me, because I always try to push the boundaries when it comes to, you know, DPing. Mm-hmm. So I remember that moment where I was riding, you know, the donkey with them, you know, leaning back and then holding my, you know, the camera on the side and just having that close shots of the kids, you know, to immerse the audience into their lives and as if they're riding with them on this, you know, everyday ride to them and then understand their world. Not only for the external audience, but also for the Sudanese people, because to the community, and that's one of the reasons why we are doing the film, because to the community, they're invisible. No one seems to care about them. No one, you can see them at the edge of your eye, but you don't really know their backstory, how they ended up being here, or what are their lives looking like. Why are they on the street from the first place? They should be in school, you know, having fun. And that also is one of the reasons why Rawia picked this story, because she wants to tell these voices. So I guess that filming them from a close range also enabled us and the Sudanese audience to a deeper, closer look without even explaining a lot, you know, with voiceover or with any kind of you know, typing or, you know, text. You just look at the imagery and then you listen to their voices and what are they saying, that this is their city. No one, you know, looks at us. We will have our line one day.
And it's so interesting that you brought up the kids, because that part of the film really stuck with me, because it's like they're kids, and the fact that they're drawing these pictures of bodies and blood, and you know, they shouldn't have to experience that. They should be you know, having drawn pictures of superheroes and reading comic books and doing the things that kids do at that age and not having these very adult experiences. So it was really heartbreaking and gut-wrenching to see that part of the film. So that also stuck with me, was with the kids. My last question to Tamia, what do you hope the audiences will learn and will walk away with after seeing this film?
سؤال الأخير لتيمي أنه حاسين شنو الجمهور هياخده معه من الفيلم, هيتأثر كيف, هيحس بشنو بعد يحضر الفيلم, الحاجة هياخدها معه شنو بعد يحضر. So I like one of the most important things for all of us is just as a start to know about Sudan. And as Rawia said, there's a lot of news reports, there's a lot of numbers. We have more than 50 million people displaced. We have a lot of conflict areas are developing, are expanding or decreasing. It's already changing. But people here does not know about Sudan. When I meet someone here, I just explain where is Sudan as a start, not just what's happening there. So I think there's also something called an emotional fatigue when people have like lots of news about a specific international conflict or something, they just don't care anymore when you have the news all around them year after year after year. And so this is a trial that we want people to feel something towards Sudan, to feel, make these kids and his also pigeons to feel Jawad's struggles, to feel Khadmullah's struggles, and to feel the kids' struggles. And to feel something about Sudan, to understand some sort of story around Sudan, and to advocate for what's happening right now with the impact campaign that we are running with our amazing producers, Giovanna and Talala Fifi. We want people to understand what's happening there. We want people to feel and to solidate with the Sudanese people, to retweet maybe, to share, to donate, to just talk to your neighbor about, I heard about a country called Sudan happening, there is something happening in it. That will be good. And also maybe policymakers can do something, can affect the current work and change a policy internationally that can support the peace building process in Sudan or the Sudanese people currently.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time to speak to Black Girl Nerds. This was such a beautiful film. I hope it gets exposed to more people, and I really appreciate the conversation today.
Thank you so much.
For giving us your time.
Thanks for tuning in to this episode of the Black Girl Nerds podcast, straight out of Park City, Utah, for the 2025 Sundance Film Festival. I am here with Travis Hobson of Punch Drunk Critics. Thank you, Travis, for coming on the show to talk all things Sundance. It's late, and
it's super late.
I appreciate you hanging in there because usually have full team.
You know what?
Here.
You know what?
This everybody's in bed.
Everybody's asleep. You and I just got back from a movie. So, you know what? Let's just go ahead and knock it out. Let's do this thing.
So, we're going to just talk about a few of the movies that we've seen at Sundance so far, because Sundance is still happening, and there's some movies that have not premiered yet that I'm still looking, or that I'm looking forward to seeing. I want to talk about what you've seen so far that you really enjoyed, and then what you've seen so far that you're like, I wasn't really that excited about.
Yeah, so I think between the two of us, we've really only seen a few movies.
Yeah.
This has not been the most prolific Sundance.
Facts.
Ever. I was coming to somebody that I think I've written maybe 4 or 5 reviews, maybe 5. In an average year, I would have done double that amount by now. It's not the strongest year for Sundance overall. And I think that's been reflected in the number of movies we've seen and reviewed. But there have been a few that I've liked a lot. And I'll start with the very first movie I saw, which was... Oh, wait, no. The first movie I saw was Magic Camp, and I did not like that. It was the second movie I saw, and that was The Ugly Stepsister. This is a Shudder film. It's coming out in Shudder probably within a few weeks, I imagine. And it's basically a dark and twisted version of Cinderella with a focus on the eldest of the ugly stepsisters. And it's really, in a way, similar to movies like The Substance, in which it tackles impossible beauty standards, this time through the lens of Brothers Grimm fairy tale, you know? So you've got the ugly stepsister who is basically going through all sorts of crazy body transformations in order to make herself more beautiful than Cinderella and undeniable to the prince, who she is obsessed with. And she's driven by a lot of factors. A stern mother, stern money-grubbing mother. Of course, the beauty standards of the time. This is a Victorian era sort of film. And yeah, it gets very gory, especially when you see like the body modifications, which are just brutal and horrific. And one of the stories that has been populating around Sundance this year is that at the premiere screening, somebody threw up. Somebody vomited at one of the scenes in this movie, and I totally get it, because there's a lot of grotesque stuff in this movie. And for the most part, the movie uses like authentic surgical techniques of the era, of the time. So you get really nasty rhinoplasty, and there's a really awful thing that they do with her eyelashes that gives me the creeps. There's a lot of stuff in this movie that is really, really...
I don't know if I want to see it.
Really, really gross. But it's also very funny, and I think it's one of those movies that is a perfect Shudder film, one of those great midnight movies. I think it's... Of the movies, we talked a lot about movies that are here that might play well at the festival but probably won't travel very far. This is one of those movies that I think will find its crowd, find its audience, and do very well.
Awesome. I think for me, the film that I've really enjoyed so far screening at the festival is Ricky. That's the film by Rashad Fred.
We saw that together.
We did. And feel free to chime in. Mm-hmm. Stephan James is the lead. Shelley Ralph is in it. And I just really enjoyed it because I really was blown away by Stephan James's performance. Mm-hmm. You really get a chance to see his range in this film. I felt like I was on an emotional roller coaster. Mm-hmm. I experienced laughter in the film. I experienced just indignant, infuriating anger at what his character experienced. I cried. I cried through probably the third act, through the whole third act of the film.
Let's tell the people what it's about a little bit.
So, Ricky is about this man by the titular character, his name is Ricky, who is incarcerated as a boy at the age of 15 and spends that same amount of time, 15 years, in prison for attempted murder. And the reason why he is even incarcerated for that crime in the first place, you find out it's actually pretty tragic. But he's trying to acclimate himself to, back into the real world. Mm-hmm. And it's a struggle because, as we know in real life, convicted felons aren't able to find real jobs or just jobs in general because of their past as convicted felons. It's almost impossible.
The world is always stacked against ex-cons.
Yeah,
especially if you're black, especially if you're poor, if you're working black. Class. And this movie was, the director, Rashad Fret, who's a Sundance darling, because this short was here a couple years ago. Mm. And so, at the premiere, everybody was there to support him in this movie. He's of Caribbean descent, and he's from Hartford, Connecticut, which is where the movie's set. Apparently, there's a very large Caribbean community there. And I agree with almost everything that you said about the movie. But I've also, I've expressed my things about it that I don't necessarily think are great.
Okay.
And which is mainly, I don't feel like it presents the community in a way that is unique. Like if somebody had just walked in and they missed like the whole intro to the movie, they would probably think it was in Los Angeles or Oakland or any other place where we've seen a lot of the movies with this kind of story told. and you wouldn't you wouldn't necessarily get that distinct Caribbean flavor that you would think you're going to get from this story. Like, I just didn't get it. And so it felt, the story felt very familiar. All the beats were familiar to me. The thing that stood out most was Stephon James, who I think is incredible.
Yeah.
He's an actor who I felt like he should have been a bigger star by now. I thought his earliest roles, like in Race and stuff like that, were showed his potential. And I think he's been good in a lot of things since. But he's never quite had that breakout. If this film were marketed the right way, it could be that breakout.
It could potentially
film for him.
Be, yeah. So yeah. It doesn't have a buyer yet, as a matter of fact. He mentioned in the Q&A,
yeah.
Like, hopefully
there's
a big war.
Please buy it.
Yeah. So we'll see, because potentially, depending on who picks it up, there could be an awards conversation around his performance.
Yeah. My fear is that it ends up being something like Rob Peace, which is another movie that came out last year at Sundance, and I thought was tremendous. Had a great lead performance.
Yes.
Directed by Chiwetel Ejiofor. It's a really great film. Mm-hmm. And then it came out and just kind of went nowhere. And that really disappointed me. And I feel like that could almost maybe happen here too, just depending on where it goes and where they put it and where it gets placed. So we'll see. But there are good things about this movie. Overall, I think it's a positive film. I think Richard Fret is a director with a lot of potential. And I said in my review that I would love for them to be like a Ryan Coogler, Michael B. Jordan type duo that maybe could progress together and move and keep growing and evolving as filmmakers, creatives together, like Fruitvale did 12, 13 years ago. I remember being here for that and being like, what the f- these guys are amazing, you know, and being so happy that they kept working together. I'd like to see these guys work together and continue to grow. So we'll see if that happens.
Is there another film that resonated with you, kind of similar to what you enjoyed with Ugly Stepsister?
Lurker is probably my top movie here.
Okay.
Lurker is an incredible film. One of those movies that, another one that will get picked up and will probably do extremely well. So it stars Archie Madekwe, who people will probably remember from Gran Turismo and Saltburn.
Yep.
And he plays a pop star, like a rising star. And there's this other guy who kind of worms his way into his inner circle, into his entourage. And he's this guy who's kind of living a basic life. He lives with his grandma. He works in retail. And he kind of fakes his way into this guy's inner circle, you know, pretending to not really be a fan, not knowing who he is. And, you know, the guy comes into a store and he plays his favorite song. He already knows the guy's favorite songs. He's already obsessed with them, but he's fakes his way into his entourage and makes himself indispensable, working like on a documentary, becomes the guy's best friend. Mm-hmm. And then it becomes like this power struggle within the group, because everybody in any celebrity's inner circle is a hanger-on, a yes man, somebody like that. And everybody's jockeying for a position to be the closest to him. And so you got this guy who will do anything, and he does do just about anything, to stay in that top position. And it gets pretty crazy. It's one of those movies that's easily marketable, especially for Archie Madekwe. If they push this right, it could be that kind of breakout role for him too. And it's just really, really entertaining. It's funny in places you don't expect. It's dark. It doesn't really get violent or anything, but it's just suspenseful the whole way through. So it's one of those movies I think is going to break out of here really easily. So that's probably my top film here so far.
I didn't get a chance to catch that one, but that is on my list of films to watch at Sundance. I'll bring up really quick, just sort of like a rapid fire of three docs that I really enjoyed at Sundance. And that's the Marley Matlin, Not Me Anymore doc. The Sly Lives doc about Sly and the Family Stone. And then Move Your Body, the Birth of House.
Oh, the Birth of House. I was wondering about that one.
Yeah. Directed by Elegance Bratton, who is an incredible director. He did The Inspection at TIFF about a year or so ago. But all of those documentaries were really great. I love documentaries. Sundance have brought some really great stuff. Last year we talked about the Luther Vandross documentary, the We Are the World doc. But I loved Marley Matlin's doc, because you just learned a lot about her. I had no idea that she lived with Henry Winkler for 2 years after she had broken up with William Hurt, which you know.
I heard he doesn't come off well in the movie.
he does not, and probably a lot of people don't know about that relationship and how toxic that was. And then going back to Sly and the Family Stone, that there were so many songs that have been sampled from his music by these contemporary artists of today. And that, you know, he sold a lot of the rights of his music, and that he hasn't really been able to profit off of his music that's being used today. So it's just, it's very interesting, just his whole story and how that played out. And then Move Your Body, the birth of house. Again, like, just sort of the commodification of, like, black culture and how that's mm-hmm. been co-opted by white artists, and how, like, a lot of these white artists have used house music, and the black folks that have, you know, created that culture mm-hmm. haven't been able to, like, monetize off of it.
Yeah.
All of that stuff is talked about in these documentaries, and it's just been very intriguing to learn, you know, that journey. So I enjoyed all three of those documentaries respectively, so...
Yeah, you know, I usually don't come to Sundance to see docs. I mean, I leave that to other people to do. I don't really watch that many of them anymore. I did see a couple this year, though. I saw the Jeff Buckley doc. Okay. It's never over, Jeff Buckley, about a musician that I honestly only knew about mainly because of the way he died so young and so suddenly. Mm. And his version of Hallelujah, which is iconic. You know, that, and the movie taught me a lot more about him and his influences, which I think is the thing that... I think I learned the most about. Like, he was influenced by Nina Simone and, you know, and of course Leonard Cohen and all sorts of different people, but people you didn't expect.
Yeah.
And people that, even some people I hadn't even heard of before. Right. The guy was well-rounded and versatile, and he could do just about anything. That made me really want to go out and learn even more about Jeff Buckley. And I saw Predators earlier today, and that was a doc about... To Catch a Predator. I was telling jokes on social media all day that I was going to see Predators, and it has Arnold Schwarzenegger and Danny Glover in it. Some people fell for it. but no, it's about the TV show To Catch a Predator, which was, I mean, if you remember that time, people were obsessed with that show. And I was one of them. I used to watch the shit out of that.
Me too.
And it kind of explores the legacy of that show. Whether or not it was a good thing or not, I think even back then, while it was on, a lot of us could feel that there was something icky about this show and the way they were doing things. Yeah, they're catching bad people, but they're also capturing people at the worst moment of their lives. Oh, they're ruining lives, and a lot of those things because of the way there's this blurring of the line between.
Wasn't there an episode where one guy actually killed himself?
Yes, that's one of the major topics of discussion in the film is that episode. Where the guy in Texas, who was an assistant district attorney, committed suicide. And NBC stupidly still ran the episode. And that's the show. That's the episode that basically got them canceled.
But the
show blurred the lines between, you know, entertainment and law enforcement in a way that has been detrimental to our society overall. Shows like Cops and other things like that have blurred that line even further. And that was not a good thing. That was a bad thing. It was a very bad thing. Yeah. It made us look at crime in a black and white way, which is never the way it should be looked at.
Right.
So there were really bad things. I had issues with the film overall. I mean, I didn't like the presentation of it. I thought it's kind of bland in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. But I also felt that it was not really useful to kind of debate whether or not the show was good or not, or whether it was worth it or not. I feel like that debate's been had for 20 years. I think it would have been a better use of time to explore the actual impact of the show by going back and kind of seeing what happened to a lot of people that were most directly affected by the show, which the movie doesn't really do. Yeah. So I had issues with the film. It's still interesting, especially if you remember the show. It's still interesting, but I would have done the movie a completely different way.
So let's talk about movies that we didn't really care for at Sundance. Is there a movie that you, just try to put it delicately,
okay.
Is there a movie that you either just completely disliked or just didn't connect with?
The one movie that I really, really dislike, you already know, and it's Magic Farm. It's just awful.
Okay.
It's one of those really quirky comedies that I imagine there is somebody out there who will like it. It stars Chloe Sevigny, who has a real hit or miss track record around here, but she's sort of a Sundance staple. You know, mm-hmm. she's one of the mainstays here at Sundance. So if she has a movie here, I usually try to go see it. Yeah. It's about this TV show crew. They do like this really awful, stupid show where they like explore weird cultural trends, and they go to this place down in South America, and it's like all their little quirky, like, relationship issues. Like, one is dating like the producer, and the show is kind of failing, and then there's this one guy played by Alex Wolff who is like a big man baby, and he's and it's just like all these little things, and the movie is just unfunny. I could not get into it. Something about it, just the presentation of it was weird. Nothing was clicking. Nothing clicks with the movie at all. Mm-hmm. And the embargo, it has a really long embargo time too. So that's another, like, that makes me like, I think they know this movie's not great.
Good.
Like, I still can't review it for like two more days. Like, ooh. It's not until Tuesday. It's like, I'm not even going to want to at that point. It's going to be like the shortest review I ever wrote.
Yeah, it's always hard to write reviews on movies that aren't good because
you're
struggling.
I don't come to these things to trash movies. Like,
No one does.
I mean, I try not to.
Yeah,
I will try to find something positive to say about the movie.
Of course.
Even though I will end up giving it a low score.
Yeah.
But just not a great movie and a really bad way to start the festival.
Right.
I usually say that the opening film that you see is usually sets the course for the festival.
Right.
I will say that it set a very low bar for the festival, mm-hmm. and that it was easy for everything else to be better.
Right.
The very next film I saw after that was really good. Like, The Stepsister was really good.
Right.
And Omaha was really good, which is another film I haven't talked about. Right. Omaha is excellent. Very sad. Very sad movie. It's only 80 minutes. It's John McGarro, plays a father, single father, a widower, takes his two children, one 9 years old, one 6, and their family dog on a road trip to Omaha. Mm-hmm. And it is just the most grief-stricken, heartbreaking trip, because the director keeps a lot of the mystery of the journey at bay. Mm-hmm. Doesn't tell us where we're going, where they're going, or doesn't tell the kids where they're going or why they're going. Eventually, you start to get this kind of idea that there's something about this that feels like a final journey,
mm-hmm.
you know? And I'm not going to give anything away, but people who know Nebraska of a certain period and certain laws that were passed during a certain period will pick up on why he's taking them to Nebraska in general. And once you realize that, it becomes even more tragic. So, but John McGarro, who I think has had one of the best 2024s. He was fantastic in a lot of different things, including September 5. He was also really good in Day of the Fight with not Dane DeHaan. Who's that guy? I forget the guy's name. Anyway, but he's really good in Day of the Fight as well, and some other stuff too. He's really busy in 2024. He's just becoming just a fantastic actor. And he's amazing in Omaha. Just so heartbreaking.
I have that on my online ticket request.
Yeah, just bring Kleenex or something.
Bring Kleenex.
Yeah, because there was not a dry eye, other than mine, of course, because I'm a man and I don't cry at movies. But if everybody else, there was not a dry eye in the place. So, okay. Just be wary.
All right, I gotta check for that one. Bring the tissues for Omaha.
Absolutely.
Noted.
Absolutely.
The one that I wouldn't say it was a bad movie. I wouldn't say it was, you know, a terrible film, but I just didn't connect with it, was Jinpa. Mm. And it makes me a little bit sad because there were so many talented actors in this film. John Lithgow, you've got Olivia Colman, and the director, which I liked her film that played at Sundance, Good Luck, Leo Grand.
Yeah.
I just thought, so to give you the premise, it's about this woman, Olivia Colman's character, her name is Hannah. She and her non-binary teenage daughter, they go to Australia to visit their grandfather, who's played by John Lithgow. And She's a film, I believe she's a film journalist, or no, she's a screenwriter, and she brings their daughter, I got to make sure I get the pronouns correct, to reconnect with the grandfather who is dying, to have a relationship with, and also to help the grandfather, by the way, John Lithgow's character, he's gay. And when he was married to their mother, Hannah, his daughter, he was actually in the closet. And then when he had Hannah, the daughter, he came out of the closet and, you know, decided to be open with his sexuality. And after he was open with his sexuality, he became an activist. So now, in the late stage of his life, Hannah decides to bring their daughter over to Australia to connect with their grandfather and sort of just and also by the way, Hannah's daughter is named Frances. Frances really is sort of needing to be able to connect with someone that understands queer identity, because Hannah is not able to articulate that language. So my issue with the film was the film didn't really know what it wanted to be. There was a lot of different plot points. I didn't know if the film was about Hannah and the Frances character. I didn't know if it was about Hannah and Jinpa, which is the John Lithgow character. I didn't know if it was about the John Lithgow character and his activism and being a, a closeted gay man. It was just all over the place.
Yeah.
And the director, this was her first time actually writing the screenplay. So I don't know if that had any issue with it. So, yeah, I just didn't connect with it. And I kind of wish I thought it was a beautiful way to kind of tell a story, I guess, from someone maybe that is, maybe I didn't connect with it because I'm not queer, but maybe someone that is, queer identifying would connect with the story better. But I will say this, I talked to two queer people that saw the film and they actually agreed with me about the plot being all over the place.
I was going to say, it sounds, just from hearing it, it sounds like a lot.
Yeah.
It sounds like a lot.
They agreed. They were like, yeah, but there were a lot of issues with the plot. So that was one film that was kind of like, And then another film for me was Rebuilding, which was the Josh O'Connor film.
Yeah, I want to see that one. At least I think I do.
It was just really slow. So I'll just keep it the
promotional photo looks slow.
Yeah. It looks really slow.
It's like anytime I see a promotional photo with Ben Whishaw in it, like, that movie looks slow. Like, I don't even know what it's about. It looks slow.
Oh, yeah. The Peter Hujar. Yeah. And I haven't seen that one yet.
Yeah,
I know.
I'm probably not going to make it. But it's just, if I see him, it looks slow.
It's like 60% of the movie I fell asleep in. So I honestly couldn't tell you what it was about.
I know we're only going to do about 30 minutes or so. So let's wrap up with the movie we just saw.
Yes. So we saw Together.
Yeah. Let's talk about that.
So Together is the Dave Franco, Alison Brie film. And
I feel like you already know if you like Dave Franco and Alison Brie before you walk in.
Yeah. And first of all, I like them anyway, because I've interviewed them before, and
me
they're
too.
Great.
Me too. Alison Brie is a lot of fun to talk to.
Yeah, yeah. They're both. Yeah, she is great to talk to.
Yeah.
But it's a horror film, and do you want to describe? Because you're good at describing.
Yeah. So so it's about a couple who are kind of taking their relationship to the next level, but things aren't quite perfect. They move to a kind of an isolated house in an isolated neighborhood in a way. And they kind of stumble upon like an underground church or something like that. That's what it appears to be. And while they're there, they become, I would say, cursed with something that seems to be drawing them together almost magnetically. And the movie is, in a way, talking about the nature of long-standing relationships, domestication, symbiotic relationships, bordering on parasitic, I would say. And the kind of the way that, our relationships, when they get too domesticated, can kind of feel that way. Mm. You know, I think that's what the movie's kind of talking about. But it's framing it in the lens of this curse that is drawing these people away while simultaneously kind of driving them apart too, further than they already were. Mm-hmm. So you get a lot of confrontations that are like double entendres in a way. You know, where it's, you know, they talk about, you know, if we split now, it'll be easier than later. And that has double meaning, you know. You get a lot of situations like that in this movie. And we come to find out that there's something a little bit larger going on than just them being cursed. But I won't give that away because this is one of those movies I think is best to go into without knowing very much. I think most of us who went in here didn't really know a whole lot about it at all. I couldn't tell you. I couldn't have told you what the plot was going in. Other than they had Dave Franco and Alison Brie. That was all I knew. Yeah. And I was better for it. But like I was telling you at the end of the movie, I was kind of waiting to decide how much I liked it based on how it would end. And yeah. I think one thing I can say about it is I think it manages to stick the landing. It's a very, very entertaining movie. It was a late night for us, and none of us got bored. It wasn't slow.
Yep.
It's funny when it needs to be. It's poignant when it needs to be. And Alison Brie and Dave Franco, for obvious reasons, have fantastic chemistry together. So there's a lot to like about this movie. And I think it's one of those that would be an easy buy for some studio out there.
Yeah.
And who will promote it very well, I think.
A24, Neon, definitely. I could see them buying it. I mean, I loved every bit of this film. I was curious as to why the Alison Brie character was sticking with this guy. Because she plays a teacher and he's like a musician, but... he's kind of not really employed, and he doesn't have a car. So
he's one of those guys who always thinks there's something better coming around the corner.
Yeah.
Or that he thinks that the dreams he's held on to his entire life are still possible.
Yeah.
Even when they're not. And he's not really moving in the direction of doing them either.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I've known lots of guys like that, and I've probably been that guy at one point or another in my life, you know? But, he's
but
one of
they're
those
still,
guys.
But they're still tethered together, and right. Both emotionally, and then we end up finding both literally. Right. So I really enjoyed it too. I love their performances. I love the sound design in this. There's some really great jump scares. I mean, I was generally terrified in some scenes, and you know, sometimes these horror movies, after you've seen one horror movie after the other, you get jaded and you think, okay, I can't get scared anymore, but no, there were some scenes that really scared me. So.
Were you ever scared at the... There were a couple good... Yeah, there was at least one really good jump scare for me in that movie. So, what about the Dev Patel one that we saw? That horror movie.
Okay, that movie... Well, first of all, it didn't scare me at all. I just...
What was the name of it? I forgot.
Oh, okay. The Dev Patel movie is called Rabbit Trap.
Rabbit Trap, that's right.
And...
I wrote a review of it and I already forgot the name of it.
Yeah. Honestly, I could not articulate to you, and maybe you could, but I could not articulate to you what this movie was about.
I mean, I don't think I could necessarily articulate what the movie was about either. It deals a lot with Celtic folklore and stuff like that, so it gets very oblique, which was my problem with it.
Yeah.
But it basically deals with, it's set in 1973, and it follows a couple who make music. But it's music basically of like natural sounds and man-made sounds, not like guitars and drums and stuff like that. It's all sound-based stuff. And so they go to this isolated cabin, like away from society.
And somehow this couple does not own a car.
I know, I don't have anything, which we've talked about our theories on the movie. But while they're out there, I think he disturbs a fairy circle. And that attracts something in the form of a boy who begins coming to the house and kind of...
And the boy is actually played by a girl.
Played by a girl. Insinuates himself into their lives teaching them about the local folklore, bringing them gifts, and also kind of playing into, I think, her parental instinct in a lot of ways too, because, you know, she maybe wants to be a mom and this kid is very needy and lonely. Mm-hmm. And the kid begins to become a bit obsessive.
Yeah. And becomes a stalker, basically.
Yeah, and a lot of strange things start happening. The biggest positive about this movie, and everybody will talk about it, the sound design in this movie is fantastic.
Yes.
It sounds amazing. The editing is gorgeous. It has an almost otherworldly quality to it. Mm-hmm. Which I think is, the atmospherics in this movie are fantastic. Story doesn't make a whole lot of sense. Unless maybe you are deep.
If you know about, cultic.
Right.
And your average friend person of mine was I can't even remember and repeat word for word exactly how she described it to me. But she said, if you understand Celtic folklore and if you understand the subtext behind it, then you'll get this movie. So it's kind of frustrating because I don't like it when filmmakers have to give you homework in order for you to understand their movie.
Yeah, I'm kind of the same way. I'm the same way. And it's fine for them to make that kind of movie, but you have to find a way to present it in a way that your casual person can still understand it.
Yeah, still understand it.
Yeah, you got to. If you don't do that, then I consider that a failing.
Exactly.
But it's a failing on you as a storyteller.
Exactly.
So that's my that was my big issue with it. There's a lot to like about that movie, and there are people that are going to love it. We have a friend who really likes it.
Yeah. But I feel like people that are going to be hardcore into that type of lore mm-hmm. will love it. But I think the general casual audience probably won't get it.
And I want to say the kid, I think his name is Jade Krute, was the kid's name.
Great performer.
Really great. As a creepy child.
Yes.
Although the person, Jade Krute, is actually like in her 20s, I think. Not really actually a child.
Really?
Yeah,
no, I think she's actually a child. That's crazy.
Yeah, so, but a fantastic performance. Like, if we're talking about great, creepy kid characters. A really good one. It's a really good one. Yeah. And Dev Patel's solid too. Dev Patel's solid. I really like the woman who plays his wife, whose name is slipping by me. Oh yeah, Rosie McEwen. That's her name.
And by the way, Elijah Wood was a producer on it.
Elijah Wood's a producer on it.
Yep. Yeah.
Yep.
Awesome. Well, this wraps up our episode. Thanks so much for tuning in. We always love talking about movies here on the podcast, but especially, you know, coming out to Sundance every year and breaking down the movies that we've loved and maybe not so loved over at Sundance. And again, it's still happening. I am actually looking forward to Opus. That's my most anticipated movie of Sundance. What's your most anticipated movie to see that hasn't premiered yet? As of this recording.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to Opus as well. I'll be going to that too. I'm kind of looking forward to Train Dreams that's coming up. But I think if the ones that are left, I'm really looking forward to Love Brooklyn in a couple days. I have not heard anything about it yet, not really. So I'm hoping it stays that way before then. So yeah, I'm looking forward to that one. Andre Holland.
I mean, he doesn't miss.
He gave me Exhibiting Forgiveness last year, and that was one in my top 20. I mean, I absolutely love that movie.
Yeah.
So, looking forward to this.
Awesome. Well, thanks so much for tuning in, and we'll see you next time. Bye.
The Black Girl Nerds podcast is produced by Jamie Broadnax. The opening theme song to our show is written and performed by Samus. Various instrumentals are performed by Samus, Sky Blue, and Shubzilla. You can find various episodes of the Black Girl Nerds podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, SoundCloud, Audioboom, Google Play Music, and Spotify.